Mexico rethinks marijuana today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Mexico's president wants to relax marijuana laws in his country, and it may have a lot to do with similar efforts north of the border.
Mexicans question the wisdom of continuing to fight the war on marijuana while the U.S. is throwing the towel.
Also, a Vietnamese immigrant who discovered Prince and David Bowie when he arrived in America. He says they helped him fit in.
They looked different. You could say that they were neither black nor white.
Plus, police officers in Nova Scotia record a silly music video in the name of road safety.
You know, if you get a bunch of Mounties out acting like goofballs and singing and dancing and making a ridiculous video, it actually helps us get the message across.
That's all ahead on The World. We're going to kick off the show today with marijuana. A semi-legal kind. Several U.S. states have legalized pot for recreational use, and more than 20 allow some form of medical marijuana. It's been a different story in Mexico, a country which, of course, has been scarred in recent years by a surge of violence related to drug trafficking. But now, after years of saying no, Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto says he wants to allow some use of medical marijuana. Alejandra Hope is security and justice editor at eldailypost.com in Mexico City. I asked him why the president changed his mind.
The growing legalization movement in the U.S. and the success that movement has had in places like Colorado, Washington, and so on and so forth has made Mexicans question what the wisdom of continuing to fight the war on marijuana while the U.S. is throwing the towel. Then more locally, there was a Supreme Court ruling last November allowed for limited production for personal consumption of marijuana for four plaintiffs. But it was important enough to open up a debate.
Is he really at this point pushing medical marijuana, or is it also a way to allow recreational use of marijuana?
No, this is not recreational at all. This is a very limited opening to medical marijuana, and the operative word is limited. Marijuana is being reclassified from a list of completely banned substances to a list of extremely controlled substances. Now it will be possible for Mexican companies, Mexican patients, to import products made from marijuana, not necessarily marijuana itself. Ultimately, it might be possible to produce some marijuana for medical research and eventually for the production of pharmaceutical products. But this will be extremely limited and it will be a slow-going process. The other part is a broader decriminalization mechanism. Right now in Mexico, if you are caught with 5 grams of marijuana or less, you are not subject to criminal charges, although it's still a crime to own any quantity of marijuana. But President Peña Nieto is proposing to raise that threshold from 5 grams to 28 grams an ounce. That could allow some people now in jail on possession charges to be freed.
How is it expected to have any impact on Mexico's black market, on trafficking of marijuana in Mexico?
No one believes that this will have any significant impact on the black market. Most of the weed that is produced in Mexico is for export. The domestic market is relatively small, both in terms of volume and value. This is probably more of a symbolic gesture.
How does this proposed law, how does it compare to what's going on in other Latin American countries regarding marijuana?
Uruguay is, of course, at the forefront of the reform process. In 2013, they approved legislation allowing for production and sale of marijuana for recreational purposes.
That's like a kind of Colorado or Washington State.
Yes, but with a much heavier state control over the process.
What about Colombia?
Colombia is moving to establish a medical marijuana program, somewhat less limited than what is being proposed in Mexico, but also not exactly a mass market on the California-Colorado model. Chile, likewise, is also moving in that direction, and some other countries might follow suit soon. But throughout the region, with the exception, of course, of Uruguay, these are mostly baby steps in the direction of marijuana legalization.
Alejandro Hope is an editor with eldailypost.com in Mexico City. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
We're going to shift gears here and talk about long-haul truckers. Hard to imagine any job more typically American than that, with the possible exception of cowboy. But these days, the trucking industry increasingly depends on drivers from all over the world. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez has our story.
50 miles west of Los Angeles, just off of Interstate 10, is one of the busiest long-haul truck stops in America. It's where tired drivers can park their 18-wheelers for the night, grab a meal and shower, and relax before hitting the road again. The truck stop is also where you'll see just how multinational the trucking industry has become because of drivers like Harsharan Singh. He's a Sikh originally from Punjab, India. Singh hauls produce all across the western U.S. and Canada and spoke to me in the cab of his truck.
I got my license back in 2009 when I came here from India. Now, a lot of people coming from like Romania, Yugoslavia, like Chinese, Japanese, Russians.
It's a global village of drivers now on America's highways.
Exactly.
Immigrants' role in U.S. trucking is growing as the industry reports a labor shortage of up to 48,000 drivers. That shortage could balloon to over 170,000 drivers in the next 10 years.
I think the trucking industry in general is searching for people.
Justin Lowry studies the role of immigrants in American trucking at the Institute for Immigration Research at George Mason University.
A lot of the truck driving industry is declining because of the aging out of the population of people who are truck drivers. And so some of the gap that's being filled in the lack of truck drivers are the recent immigrants to the U.S. who are generally of working age and willing to work long hours and hard to support their families.
Are you all Ukrainian-born, Russian-born?
A small but growing number of truckers on U.S. highways come from Russia, Ukraine, and other former Soviet republics.
Well, when I first got to this country, I never thought I was going to do this kind of job. I mean, it was a sort of a dream to do it.
I met Stephen Abramovich, who's originally from the Ukraine, as he enjoyed an outdoor meal of cold cuts, hard-boiled eggs, and some wine with fellow Ukrainian and Russian drivers in a corner of the vast truck stop. He says a trucker is a trucker, but feels foreign-born drivers, because of language and culture, form a tighter community than American drivers.
We're raised differently. I don't want to be disrespectful to the American community, but Russian community and Turkish community and Ukrainian community and all the Europeans, they're more friendly. You know, there's some of the people, like, you know, we're sitting right now that I don't even know. But we're sitting together, we're having a nice meal.
American truckers tend to be what, more solitary
types?
I mean,
take a look at this truck stop where we're at right now. 550 trucking spots. Do you see anybody gather together but us?
There's no social life.
Exactly. Mm. There's nobody sitting down together, gathered together just like us.
Ismail Abbasov started driving an 18-wheeler 3 years ago. He grew up in both Russia and Turkey and says that although he hasn't had many opportunities to socialize with American drivers, they've always offered a helping hand when he's needed it.
When I saw it the first time, I didn't know this job. You know, I'd never done, but I was asking and they helped me a lot.
But a lot of American truckers, especially the veterans, warn new drivers that the trucking life can be brutal. There are tight deadlines, often leading to substance abuse, and the long stretches away from home can be hard on marriages. Trucker Yancey Shipman has been at it for over 30 years and has had his share of problems.
It is a way of life. It rules your being. It used to be a joke, you know, you knew one thing certain about driving a truck. If you make plans, you ain't going to be there.
But despite the hardships, many immigrant drivers say the trucking life represents their road to the American dream. For The World, I'm Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
There are other versions of the American dream. Japanese immigrants have been settling in Brazil for more than a century, and today there are over a million Brazilians of Japanese descent. But just in the past 25 years, thousands of them have gone back to Japan. Filmmakers Aaron Litvin and Ana Paula Hirano have followed three Japanese-Brazilian families who've made that journey. Their documentary, In Progress, is called One Day We Arrived in Japan. We start off with Aaron.
I've always had a personal interest in immigration. My parents are immigrants from the former Soviet Union. And I was fascinated by the fact that hundreds of thousands of migrants went from Japan to Brazil. And since 1990, when the Japanese government changed a law, hundreds of thousands of Brazilians of Japanese descent have gone to Japan. So Ana Paula and I decided to embark on this journey, starting in Brazil, meeting people before they were immigrants, when they just had the idea, and going across the world to meet them again in Japan.
Ana Paula, you're Japanese-Brazilian yourself. What was your community like growing up?
In São Paulo, there is a big Japanese community, but most of my friends and colleagues were not of Japanese descent. But I think that that's the reality of most of people in Brazil. They are all like descendant of different heritages.
It's interesting. Japanese Brazilians these days are going back to Japan for the very same reasons that the Japanese originally came to Brazil, to work and make a better life. Aaron, I want to come back to you, that you and Ana Paula followed three families that moved from Brazil to Japan. What happened to them?
One family ended up staying for a couple of years and then returned to Brazil. Another couple, they stayed for several years but had a very taxing experience there and returned to Brazil as well. And one of the families, and we're going to hear a clip from this family, from their younger son, they had also a very challenging time but are still there today.
The boy you're referring to is named Bruno. Set up the clip for us. What's happening?
Bruno was 5 years old when he arrived to Japan. And he didn't speak Japanese, so it was a very new experience for him. This is Bruno speaking in 2008. When I started first grade at the Japanese school, I didn't understand anything, and I cried and cried. It made me want to return to the airport and return to Brazil. I stood there wondering, what are they doing? What are they saying? Then I thought, I'll stop doing what I want, and I'll imitate them.
Aaron, you actually showed Bruno this recording 7 years later. You were still following him and his family. How did he respond then?
We went back to Japan last year, and Bruno didn't remember the first interview. He's now starting his first year of high school, and he became a bit emotional. Now he feels equally comfortable speaking in Japanese and in Portuguese. So he says in Japanese, in the future, I want to live here in Japan. But if I have money and vacation time, I'd like to return to Brazil once, to travel and to see my grandma and aunt. I haven't seen them in about 10 years. And then he switches to Portuguese and says, my mom says that when I speak Portuguese, I'm Brazilian, and that when I speak Japanese, I'm Japanese. But I identify as Brazilian.
Ana Paula, you are Japanese-Brazilian. You follow these families with Aaron for all these years. For Brazilians who return to Japan, what does their future look like?
Actually, when the Japanese government thought about accepting second and third generation of Japanese descent, they thought that because they were of Japanese descent, they would adapt easier. But the reality was different. They couldn't speak the language. In Brazil, we kiss, we touch, we talk to people closer, we are considered louder to the Japanese standards. When you have you look Japanese, but you don't speak the language and you don't know how to behave in the Japanese way, let's say, then it breaks the expectations.
Aaron Litvin and Ana Paula Hirano are the directors of One Day We Arrived in Japan. You can find a link to their Kickstarter campaign on our website, PRI.org. Thanks, Aaron and Ana Paula.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Coming up, what Prince and David Bowie meant to one Vietnamese refugee on the world. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. When we heard that Prince had died suddenly yesterday, I had an intense yearning to hear his music. But if you go online looking for Prince songs, you might be out of luck. Like this song, Slave, from his Emancipation album that he released in 1996. Prince wasn't a huge fan of online streaming services or the music industry in general. That's putting it lightly. He made that clear in this song, which refers to his split from Warner Brothers. He called himself a slave to the label and dropped his name. Nancy Baim has been researching artists' relationship with their audience and the digital world. Nancy, what are some of the major moments in Prince's career where we see the tension between him and the label companies?
Well, I think you've just identified the main one when he writes Slave on his face and he changes his name to an inscrutable symbol as an effort to get out of his recording contract. He's not the only artist to feel that the terms and conditions of the recording contract were unfairly prohibitive.
What is it about these companies that angered him? What aspects of the relationship is the one he's really chafing against?
In general, recording contracts last considerably longer than employment contracts are able to legally, and this follows from a court case that Olivia Newton-John did in the 1970s where she tried to get out of her recording contract. Because you can do a recording contract for a number of albums, you can actually end up having to work for more years for a label than you would have to if you were employed as a straight employee, because if you sign, say, 7 albums and it takes you 20 years to do 7 albums, then you're stuck in a 20-year contract. So it's sort of like what Kesha's going through right now, where you want to have artistic control and you want to be able to make your own decisions about your music, and you're beholden to a company that has basically an indefinite contract on your productivity. If you're not recording for them, then you're not allowed to record for anybody else, and if you're recording, it has to be for them. So Prince was such a perfectionist about his work and every aspect of it that must have been incredibly cloying for him and constraining.
But in the confines of that contract, can't he produce whatever he wants?
It would depend on the contract. In a lot of cases, contracts will specify how much creative control you have.
You mentioned he famously wrote the word slave on the side of his face. What was his point?
Well, I think his point was that he was in a form of indentured servitude to the record label, where he wasn't able to just walk away and do his work. I mean, if you think about it, you and I are in positions where if we decide we don't like our jobs, we can resign and we can go find a new job. But if you have a record contract, you can't actually do that because you're committed into your future. And it's not as though you can say, I said I'd do 7 albums. I think I'm actually going to do 4. And now I'd like to go get a new contract. If you've signed for 7 albums, you're in under those terms for 7 albums.
How do you think his resistance to online streaming and pulling his music off of YouTube and all that, how did that impact his reach with his audience?
Well, that's kind of the beauty and magical thing about Prince, is that common wisdom would have you believe that if you do that, you're doomed, but it didn't seem to affect his popularity at all, which is a credit to the strength of his music and the power of his connections with his audiences, that he didn't need that to be able to foster that relationship with his audiences. And you could probably make a case that it helped make him even more mysterious and enigmatic in ways that had appeal.
How successful was he in these various battles with online streaming or with music labels?
Well, you know, it's a lot like whack-a-mole. With the labels, he ended up being able to pursue his career the way he wanted. With the streaming services, he's been able to control where his music streams and where it doesn't. With things like YouTube videos and audience activities, it's much more of a whack-a-mole problem. And he was very successful. And even in the last 24 hours, I've heard a lot of reports about people trying to post things and having them taken down, and sort of the disappearance of a lot of Prince's music from the internet in the last 24 hours as fans have been trying to upload things and share and grieve together. So in a sense, he's been very successful at having things taken down. That said, very often I will see people post to Facebook or to Twitter and they'll say, quick, watch this amazing performance of Prince doing whatever before it's taken down. And then it'll get taken down shortly thereafter, but in that brief meantime. So fans keep putting things up to share with one another, and then his people would continuously be having them taken down. So, and I can imagine that will go on into the future as well with his work.
What was his objection to the online services? Was it that his stuff was going to be morphed into something it wasn't, or simply control and revenue?
My understanding is that it was about control. One of my favorite moments of Prince exerting control that just shocked me, but also made me marvel at how much his fans love him. He was issuing takedown notices for photographs that fans had posted of tattoos of his face that they had on their body. So people were posting photos of their own tattoos, their own body with his image, and he would send takedown notices. And they loved him anyway, right? They didn't go have them eliminated, which, like I said, just speaks to how much people truly, truly love him.
Nancy Baim is a researcher at Microsoft Research. Thanks for stopping by our studio today, Nancy.
My pleasure.
It's a big loss in a short space of time. Prince yesterday and also David Bowie just a few months back. For the man we're going to hear from now, it's not just their music. These artists help him find his place here in the U.S.
My name is Sunny Lay. I came to the U.S. as a refugee from Vietnam in 1981. I was 17. When I arrived in America, the music was, in a way, racially divided, demarcated, I'd say. You had soul and R&B for African Americans, and you had rock and roll and country and Western for white Americans. And so where would a refugee from Vietnam fit in? I had nowhere to go. Lo and behold, the music of David Bowie and Prince busted out onto the radio airwave. It was so refreshing, and it was danceable. I wanted to dance, but I didn't look the part. I didn't know how to boogie on Soul Train. But David Bowie and Prince, they had everything. They had rock and roll, they had soul, they had R&B, funk, everything that I wanted to do and dance to and listen to. And on top of that, they looked different. You could say that they were neither black nor white. And that was really liberating for somebody who tried to find a place in this really confusing place. Well, you know, that's amazing. I didn't know what a little red Corvette looked like. I was in San Francisco at the time. I don't think I ever seen one, but that song would just blew me away. I mean, little red Corvette. The sound was just so amazing. And you got to remember that at that time, MTV was just launched. And so the visuals were captivating for me. At that point, I was soaking in everything Americana. And seeing them on TV, that was too much. And I loved every second of it. I could be me finally, basically.
Sunny Lay is a media consultant in San Francisco. Lots of people are mourning Prince. I follow global satire for the world, and as soon as the news came, so did the cartoons. We've got a collection up on our website, PRI.org. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, we visit a camp for migrants in France and meet some of the people who are stuck there, including this young Bedouin from Kuwait.
I forget my childhood.
You left when you were 16?
15, and now I am 21 with nothing.
That story ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. President and Mrs. Obama are in London bearing gifts today. The Queen's celebrating her 90th birthday, and they brought her a photo album with snapshots of her visits with American presidents and first ladies. But Obama isn't just there to give birthday wishes. He also has a message for regular British citizens. Please don't leave the European Union. They vote on that in June.
The United States wants a strong United Kingdom as a partner. And the United Kingdom is at its best when it's helping to lead a strong Europe.
Okay, that's Obama's view, but is he overstepping his bounds here? For that, we go to my colleague Rob Watson with the BBC in Westminster. Rob, what do you make of Obama's comments about Britain needing to stay in the EU?
I mean, they certainly didn't need any careful interpretation by British voters. I mean, this wasn't the sort of careful tiptoeing and diplomatic fiddling about that you might have expected on some occasions. I mean, this was a really full-throated, direct, absolutely unambiguous endorsement from Britain's membership of the European Union. And of course, for that, David Cameron, who is, I guess, the official leader of the Stay campaign, will be immensely grateful, because essentially Barack Obama's message to the British people was, look, as the United States is your closest ally, we want you in the EU. But if I was in your position, if I looked at this huge single market that the EU is, if I considered issues of security, of Britain's influence in the world, well, hey, it's a no-brainer.
Do you think President Obama should even enter this debate?
Well, there are lots of people, obviously, on the side of Brexit, Britain's potential exit from the European Union, as called, who say, absolutely not, but out. But I guess one would put it this way, perhaps if the United States had intervened on behalf of those who wanted to leave the European Union, you know, would they be worried about the intervention of the President of the United States? Look, I think a lot of the ferocity of the opposition from those who oppose President Obama's intervention, in a way, it's because they are hypersensitive about this issue of exit, of Brexit not having much support or any support, indeed, among Britain's traditional allies. So it's one of the reasons why the Out campaign is so sensitive, because they know it's one of their weak spots.
London's Mayor Boris Johnson had some comments of his own. He said Obama may have an ancestral dislike of the British Empire because of his Kenyan roots. How did that play in Britain?
Well, lots of people on the stay side latched onto it and said, whoa, there's a really big kind of whiff of racism about this. And Boris Johnson has been careful to kind of say that that's not what he meant at all. But certainly people had pounced on those remarks. But I think most interestingly, President Obama himself has just totally rejected that and has just been constantly emphasizing, look, the United States and the UK are in many ways, in security terms, economically, history, language, you name it, sort of joined at the hip. And of course, in the light of his rather kind of a happy lunch with the Queen and Prince Philip, I mean, sort of somehow describing him as being anti-British all looked rather awkward. Whatever way you sugarcoat this particular pill, this kind of intervention from a US president is bad news for those who are campaigning for Britain to leave.
Ultimately, what do Brits think of Obama these days? And will his visit really have any influence in how they vote this summer?
Well, the opinion polls suggest that he's far more popular here than any British politician, that's for sure. Look, I think the short answer to your question is, look, David Cameron, Downing Street, the British government, the Stay campaign, they would have not have coordinated this visit by President Obama if they didn't think on balance that, sure, some people are going to say, I'm not going to be told what to do by an American president, but that on balance, most people who are undecided are thinking, well, we don't like the EU very much, but hey, none of our allies, and now the United States has weighed in saying they don't think it's a good idea to leave, that will plant a doubt in people's minds. And that is exactly what David Cameron wants. I mean, he will hope that people switching on their evening newses in Britain tonight will say, well, you know, I mean, President Obama, I mean, OK, so he's not going to be in office that much longer, but he doesn't think it's a good idea that we should leave. Maybe I'll give it a second thought.
The BBC's Rob Watson in London. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
One of the toughest challenges facing Britain and the rest of the EU is the migrant crisis and how to house people humanely while they're stuck in limbo. Some of the migrant camps have notoriously awful conditions, like one in France near Dunkirk, where 1,500 people had been living in tents. They got a substantial upgrade last month when they were moved to a brand new $3.4 million facility funded mostly by Doctors Without Borders. We sent reporter Adeline Sear back to Grand Saint to check it out.
The former migrants' camp was located on a floodplain where migrants lived in the mud and the trash. But the new camp is on dry ground with a long stretch of gravel road where kids can ride bikes. Raphaël Etcheberry is a spokesperson for Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. He says major changes here include dry ground, a full-size medical clinic, and a non-profit that runs the camp. Today, we feel like we're on a much more viable structure, he says. We see smiles, people get busy, kids ride bicycles, play soccer, same with the adults. It seems people are living again here, whereas on the old camp, they were subjected to weather conditions and everything else. Gone are the flimsy camping tents. What you see now are small wooden shelters with plenty of toilets and showers for everyone. The shelters have heat and are numbered, so people can find each other. There's also a grocery store, a laundry facility, a kitchen, and a soccer field. A little bit of comfort is especially important for some people. This is Lass. He's a healthy 11-month-old boy with blue eyes. His dad, Iskander Karani, says life has definitely improved for the family.
We have room. Before we have tent, we can't stand up. But now we can do everything here.
Good. It turns out his neighbor is a woman I had met at the old camp, Gona Aziz. She's an Iraqi Kurd with four young children. She seems in much better spirits than 3 months ago when she was living in a tent. Aziz says she likes the new camp and the fact that the kids can play and ride their bikes nearby, but it's still cramped quarters and there's often no hot water. To say that the relative comfort of this new camp is giving hope to the people who live in it would be a stretch. Further down the main alley, I meet Youssef Hamoudi, a Kurd from Syria. He's been stuck in France for 3 years. He's more worried about the families living next door than himself. One woman there is heavily pregnant.
Please, please, European Union, take out from this place this family. No problem, leave a single man. I'm single, whatever. If I sleep here, if today I don't eat, no problem. But small kids and women pregnant, you see by your eyes, you see the pregnant time coming. We need just move this family here.
Across the alley from Hamoudi's quarters, there's a large poster of Justin Bieber. I remember seeing it in the old camp, pinned to a tent. It belongs to Faris Al-Dufairi, who's from Kuwait. Al-Dufairi is a Bedouin, which makes his case a bit more complicated than other migrants because he's stateless. He's hoping to reunite with family in England. He's been on the road for quite some time and is frustrated.
I forget my childhood. I can't say anything.
You left when you were 16?
15 and half like this. Now I see I am 21 with nothing. I would like I have a life, have a job. Just I won't finish my dream, like finish my student and be like translator man or engineer. But in this time, I feel I am in jail.
In jail?
Yeah, like not in the life.
For Al-Dufairi, the camp's new clean showers are nice, but they can't solve his problems.
I don't feel I am human today. Today is nothing, nobody today, like robot, you know?
His state of mind is not surprising to Florence van der Bocht. She's a site coordinator for the NGO Doctors of the World. She says now that people don't have to worry about freezing or starving, more essential problems are coming to the fore.
Obviously, there is a big improvement about the first needs in the new camp, like access to food, water, shelters, basic security. But the real problems of the people living there are not those. The real deep problems are that they have to get somewhere where they can build a life again. In the head of most of them, that place will be England. So the basic problem is still that they stop there right at the border.
Faris Al-Dufairi does feel stuck. All his family's cash was used to get relatives to England, and he's the only one left without a cent. So now, looking at Justin Bieber on the poster, he says, we're the same age, but he has everything.
I don't like to be a rich man like him, but I would like a simple life, not more. Passport, ID card. And this is not life, actually.
Is it closer to a life, though? You have a roof over your head.
I told you that. We're living like chicken in farm. In the night we get the sleeping, and then in the morning we get a food. So we like this, not more.
When I checked back with Al-Dufairi later on, he was still at the camp, still stuck in what he calls his chicken house, but still determined to reach England one day. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Grande Sainte, France.
We've been hearing this week from our friend Sonia Narang. She's just back from 3 weeks in Nepal, reporting on the aftermath of last year's massive earthquake. This coming Monday marks the one-year anniversary of that disaster. While Sonia was there, she went to check on a remarkable woman she profiled for us back in 2013.
Bimla is this amazing health worker I met a few years ago. She lives in a very remote mountain village in Kavre district, and this was one of the hardest hit districts in the Nepal earthquake a year ago. And I went back to see her again this month.
And what did you find when you visited her again in her home?
So I found that she herself lost her home. I arrived at her house to find her looking really great in this beautiful pink outfit and followed her up this red dirt path to her house. and was shocked to see how badly her house was destroyed. There's literally nothing left except for bricks and a ladder. And here's what she told me. So here she's telling me that on the actual day of the earthquake, she had no idea who was alive and who died. In fact, she thought that it was perhaps only her that had survived and her family members. And she ran to her niece's house and found that her four-year-old niece was buried in the rubble. She tried to rescue her, but this little child did not make it out alive, which was an unbearable loss.
Mm. I remember from your story several years ago about her that she was quite a leader in her community. What did that mean for her after the quake?
So, Carol, soon after the quake, she just rushed to the front lines as a health worker and as someone who everyone looks up to. She knew it was her responsibility to help people, especially the women and children. She especially didn't want mothers and babies to die because they didn't have access to medicine.
What about Bimla's own prospects? Will she be able to rebuild her house?
So, Carol, the situation for Bimla is incredibly sad. She has no money to rebuild her home. And when I asked her how long it might take to reconstruct a house, she started to cry. She got so emotional in the middle of the interview. So here she's saying that the government has a five-year plan to distribute money. So God only knows when she's going to get the reconstruction funds. Carol, she's now living in a makeshift shelter. This is a one-room tin shack that she built on her own. And she's cooking, since she has no kitchen, she's cooking in this den where her cow and goats live. And here's what she said about that. So here she's saying that she used to teach everyone in her village that people and animals should not live together. And today, she finds herself staying and cooking with these animals.
It's really devastating to hear how this earthquake can set Bimla and a whole rural village back years. What were you thinking when you said goodbye to her on this visit? What struck you?
What struck me was her tenacity. She is just continuing to look out for everyone in her community. I mean, she is in such despair herself, but she had the smile on her face and was actually coordinating to distribute food to local aid workers in her town, despite the fact that she has no house of her own. So she just continues to be a rallying spirit for everyone there, which is so amazing for me to see.
Does Bimla have her own family that she lives with?
She does. So Bimla has a 14-year-old daughter, Sonika, who is a very sweet girl, and she's making sure that Sonika can continue to go to school. And that's what she said. She said that, I want to make sure to pay for her school fees and to be able to continue to educate her, which is why she can't get around to spending money on building a new house right now.
And I imagine she's going to stay put. She's not thinking of leaving her village or moving anywhere else.
No, I mean, she's lived here for so long. Everybody knows her. And, you know, without her, people wouldn't really have access to medicines or any kind of services. I mean, she's almost like the local doctor for this town as one of these community health workers. She's a really important figure there.
Sonia Narang is just back from Nepal, where she's been reporting on the aftermath of last year's earthquake. Sonia, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Sonia made a short video about Bimla when she was there a few years back. It's up on our Facebook page. Just look for PRI's The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. It's almost a cliche to say this. Russia is in love with chess. Grandmasters there are celebrated like sports heroes, and the country has produced some of the greatest chess players of all time. But now many players are discovering the same skills can be used to dominate in online poker. It's not legal there, but it's on the rise. Gregory Mathieu looked into this for Bloomberg View. Gregory, explain this to me. How big is online poker in Russia?
Well, it's double the population of Belgium. It's 20 million people playing poker there that we know. There may be more people because, you know, some of them are hiding behind different identities or through different emails. But, yeah, it's a matter of 20 to 25 million people playing poker online.
Why are chess players so good at playing poker?
Well, because poker is not simply, as people could imagine, a game of luck. You have to put some thought in what you're doing if you don't want to lose all your money. So it requires a lot of analysis, because there is a number of possibilities. When you have the cards in your hands, you may guess what the other has, what is still in the pot. And from there, developing some, you know, methodology, you can indeed improve your level. This is kind of the same skills that is requested for playing chess. And Russians were and are still very good in playing chess. They are the masters in that. So I really believe that if they, let's say, transfer those skills to the poker, there's no doubt that they will be soon a world champion in that game.
What do Russian chess grandmasters and traditionalists think about players leaving chess for poker?
Well, maybe they play poker themselves. I don't know. I think they regard it maybe as a more popular sport, more American-style-like sport, where chess is more a game for gentlemen, so to say. When you have this image of a poker player with sunglasses and headphones and listening music, that's a bit different style than a chess player. But I think you can be a good chess player and a wonderful poker player. I mean, this is not incompatible.
Is the lure the money?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you go online and you play €5, it's not really for the money that you're playing, to get money, just for the pleasure. And online, it allows you also, you have some chats, you have some capacity to discuss with other people from all around the world. And it's a window to the world somehow. While those willing to play a couple of thousands, they are more rare.
How is the Russian government responding to all this?
Well, for now, online poker is considered illegal. And I think they should really see it from a different angle, because there is, first of all, some money to make from the income it can create. And you cannot keep 20 to 25 million people illegal in doing something which is really not wrong. It is better to play poker than to watch some, you know, video. So the Russian authorities are slowly, but certainly considering to make it legal.
Are Russians concerned that this incredible thing they're known for, which is chess playing, is kind of on the decline and they're going to lose something special about Russian culture?
No, I don't think so. I mean, traditionally, chess is even teaching school in Russia. This is also a game that is played in family. Grandfather getting his young little son to play chess. And this is different with poker. I mean, poker, is you don't play poker two. I mean, you play poker 5, 6. It's more socializing. And you don't play poker when you are 8 years old. You should have really an age to play poker. So I don't think there is an interference here. I mean, you can still continue to play both game. And this will not diminish the interest for chess if more and more people are playing poker. I mean, there is no competition, in fact.
At this rate, can you imagine that online poker players in Russia will someday be hailed like chess grandmasters?
As I said, I mean, I myself from time to time playing a few dollars online, and most of the time the people who are taking me those dollars are Russians. So they're playing and they are quite successful. They can certainly create a generation of champion if it's not yet existing.
Gregory Mathieu with Bloomberg View. Thanks, Gregory.
Cheers, bye.
Finally today.
You used to call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. And I know when that hotline bling.
That's Canadian rapper Drake's mega hit Hotline Bling. And here's a new version of it.
You just sped right past my cruiser. You nearly hit my leg. You sped past my cruiser. Shoulda changed your lane. Cause you know when these cop light bling.
That's Cop Light Bling. It's from a video made by the Nova Scotia Police Department. A handful of police officers dance around a squad car and sing about road safety. Corporal Jennifer Clark is one of the police officers in the video. She joins me now from Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. Corporal Clark, it's a funny video, but it's a serious message, isn't it?
It is a serious message. We have a law in Nova Scotia. It's called the Move Over Law. It's what it's commonly known as. And our police officers out on the road are telling us over and over again that they really aren't seeing that the public is aware of the law. What the law really does state is that if there's a first responder, police, fire, or ambulance type vehicle on the highway with their lights flashing, motorists are required to slow down to 60 kilometers an hour or the posted speed limit, whichever is lower. and move into the lane farthest from the first responder's vehicle if it's safe to do so.
Is the idea that cars have been coming way too close to you guys?
Way too close and way too fast. So we're really trying to promote it and get it out there in a really unique way that people will remember, and we're really seeing the results of that online.
Really? So what are people saying?
People are saying they didn't know about the law, but, you know, if you get a bunch of Mounties out acting like goofballs and singing and dancing and making a ridiculous video, it actually helps us get the message across. So the response has been overwhelming.
And you're a backup dancer in the video. Did you guys try to parody Drake's signature Drunk Uncle dance moves?
You know what? I honestly didn't know it was called the Drunk Uncle dance move, but we certainly tried to parody the moves that we saw in the video.
The video has had almost 500,000 views on YouTube. Are you guys celebrities at this point?
We are super excited at how much of a response we've received. We had no idea it would go this far, but we've certainly got a huge response.
Any word from Drake?
We certainly notified Drake's people of the video. It's not like we've done it without doing that. But that's the thing.
Corporal Jennifer Clark is one of the police officers in the video Cop Light Bling. It's now up at PRI.org if you want to see Corporal Clark and the other officers dance and sing about road safety. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Ever since May 2010, you can get fined if you don't slow down. When police stop on the road now, this legislation ain't no vote now. And ever since May 2010, you can't get fined.
Our theme music is composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Marco's back in the chair next week. Have a great weekend.
Please don't speed right past my cruiser. Move to the other lane. Sweet past my cruiser. Please let me.
PRI, Public Radio International.